The First Amendment is considered the cornerstone of the U.S. Constitution. It says that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. But how the amendment is interpreted has changed over time. Most recently, the Supreme Court has taken up a handful of cases that reference First Amendment rights in unexpected ways, from organized labor fees to non-members who enjoy the fruits of collective bargaining, to the question of whether a Colorado baker is obliged to make a wedding cake for a gay couple. Coming up, new interpretations of the First Amendment, what it means. That's after the news on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News and online at WOSU.org. Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The First Amendment is considered a cornerstone of the U.S. Constitution. The amendment says that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the governor for a redress of grievances. But how the amendment is interpreted has changed over time. The Supreme Court this term took up a handful of cases that reference First Amendment rights in unexpected ways, from organized labor fees to non-members who enjoy the fruits of collective bargaining, to the question of whether a Colorado baker is obliged to make a wedding cake for a gay couple. Brent Kendall is a legal affairs reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He covers the Supreme Court, and he joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Brent.
Thanks for having me.
I use the word unexpected. It's just that, is it just to lay people who aren't paying attention, or is the First Amendment a common theme before the Supreme Court?
Well, it is a common theme. I guess what you could say is unexpected is the mix of cases we've had. I mean, this court has been a very pro-free speech court, and in a lot of cases in recent years, there's been some, you know, agreement among liberal and conservative justices in several cases. This term that just ended was a little different because we had some that were much more ideologically polarizing, and, you know, depending on which side you listened to, the conservative justices would say, you know, we are still, you know, applying strong First Amendment protections, whereas the liberals would say, no, you know, in some of the cases, this term, what the conservatives are doing is construing the First Amendment in ways that inhibit, you know, general government regulations that in the past governments would have thought that they were free to enact. And they've accused the conservatives of starting a campaign to use the First Amendment as a weapon against some of these types of regulations.
In fact, Justice Elena Kagan referred to it as weaponizing, or she said in her dissent that
Correct.
The organized labor case, the ruling in that case, had weaponized the First Amendment.
Right. So that was, you know, on the last day of the term, and things were already kind of heated and tense for a number of reasons. But this is the case where this is a 5-4 case where the conservative majority, in an opinion by Justice Samuel Alito, ruled that state laws requiring public employees to pay union dues for the union's collective bargaining activities violated the First Amendment because it required people who opposed union activities to effectively support them. The liberals on the other side said, look, you know, the portion of the fees they were being required to pay went towards things like collective bargaining, you know, and workplace issues as opposed to speech by unions. And so that prompted, you know, Justice Alito read a long section of his opinion from the bench, and that Justice Kagan then read a portion of her dissent from the bench, which, you know, dissenters don't do that often. And when they do it, it's intended to signal how much they disagree with what the court has done. You know, and the two of them sit right next to each other on the bench. So, you know, there was a good half hour or more where they were basically, you know, having a debate, you know, a fairly heated disagreement in front of a public audience, you know, as to the proper application of the First Amendment there.
And that's pretty unusual, right?
It is. I mean, you know, by the time we get to June, which is the last month of the
right.
term, the court has saved the most difficult cases generally toward the end. So, I mean, you know, it's often the case that the most divisive cases come, you know, late in the month, and this happened to be one of them. You know, that was you know, as you said, I mean, we had several speech cases this year, and that was the one that was kind of the final crescendo.
The divisiveness on the court, is this, is Justice Kagan suggesting that there's more to come on this score?
Well, I think so. I mean, her point was, you know, that there are all sorts of professional and economic regulations that at least lightly touch on speech. And as far as she's concerned, you know, if you extend the majority's logic, then, you know, that raises some questions about those types of laws. I mean, Justice Stephen Breyer, in a dissent a few days earlier in this California case that we can talk about involving crisis pregnancy centers, said the same thing. You know, this was a case where California had passed a statute that sort of targeted these pro-life centers in California that provide some services to women who are pregnant. And the law basically required that, A, these centers disclose that the state actually offers, you know, low-income residents free healthcare services, including abortion. And there was another section of the law that said, you know, for these centers that are unlicensed, they need to actually disclose to people that they're unlicensed. And so, you know, the five conservatives who formed the majority said that the state was effectively forcing these centers to engage in speech that was contrary, you know, to their core mission, which was to, you know, encourage women to carry their pregnancies to term and to not, you know, not have abortions. And again, it's the same thing from Justice Kagan in the union's case. Justice Breyer said, you know, the understanding that you're articulating of the First Amendment here is different than what governments would have commonly understood previously, and that could call a whole range of potential regulations into question.
Right, because when I was covering State House, 25 years ago, laws were getting passed hither and, you know, all over the place in response to the 1992 Supreme Court ruling that gave states more power to regulate abortion, laws, and one of them was that in Ohio they immediately started forcing Planned Parenthood, you know, and other agencies that provide abortion counseling and abortions to the public, that they had to start talking about other options, and they were forcing them to say that.
Right.
Is there any suggestion that that's going to be turned on its nose as well?
Well, I mean, that was one of the tricky things in that case, because, I mean, these kind of disclosure requirements can cut both ways,
yeah.
Right? I mean, if governments aren't going to be able to require pro-life outfits to say certain things, then, you know, that logic would also apply on the other side of the coin. So, I mean, some of that may be fleshed out in future cases. I mean, I will point out, I mean, as I said, there have been other cases that aren't quite so divisive, even in the abortion context. I mean, we did have a case a few years back involving some restrictions in Massachusetts on, you know, how close anti-abortion centers could come anti-abortion protesters could come to clinics to protest.
Mm-hmm.
And the court, with some agreement across the board, said, look, you know, the Massachusetts law goes too far in limiting these protesters' speech. So, I mean, they're not all 5-4 cases, but it just so happened that this term, the most prominent ones were. And of course, you know, we had a couple of other cases that touched on speech issues too. At least one of which you referenced in the same-sex wedding case.
Masterpiece Cake Shop. That was actually the first case that attracted so much attention. It had to do with the religion piece as far as how they ruled, because they didn't actually rule on the issue of whether or not he should provide the cake. It was more to how the Civil Rights Commission in Colorado responded at the time.
Correct. I mean, they took a really narrow path to resolve the case. I mean, I think in part because they found it an incredibly difficult one. But, you know, as the case came to the court, I mean, one of the big issues was a core free speech issue. I mean, this baker, who's a religious guy, said, you know, the cakes that he makes are basically art, and that art is a form of expression, and that if he'd been forced to make a cake for this couple, you know, he's being forced to speak through his art with something he disagrees with.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was religious freedom questions in there as well. You know, as the case came to the court, and, you know, Justice Kennedy, who wrote the court's opinion, said, you know, that the free speech aspect of the case was difficult, and that traditionally, you know, people wouldn't have seen a wedding cake as the kind of thing that someone thought of as protected speech, but you know, he did also hint that people's views of what is speech can change over time. But at least for now, I mean, they've ducked that question and sent it back on narrow grounds and said that the baker was not treated well by the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. And I mean, that issue in another case is certain to come back again in the future, you know, and it will be in front of a court that no longer has Justice Kennedy.
Any sense about how this nominated a new member, not a new member yet, but Brett Kavanaugh, will be responding to these kinds of issues?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, he has a 12-year record on the appeals court here in Washington, D.C. You know, most of their cases deal with federal rules and regulations. So, but he's a pretty conservative guy across the board, and most people expect that he generally will approach these kinds of issues like other conservatives on the court. So, I mean, I think you'll see the same kinds of breakdowns that we've seen previously.
And the court returns to work, as we all know, the first Monday in October. And I'm wondering, are there any cases coming down the pike to the court that will address, you know, will hit on the First Amendment as well that we want to, think about going forward?
Well, I will say for now, I mean, this is a pretty big term at the court with a lot of potentially blockbuster cases. The cases that we have lined up so far for next term are not quite as exciting. Mm-hmm. You know, there's been some speculation as to why that is. And so when we get a new justice on the court early on, they will, you know, if it's Kavanaugh, I mean, he'll be able to kind of ease in without some of these hot button things. But there are other things on the horizon, including, again, you know, a return of a case kind of like the Masterpiece Cake Shop case that the court will certainly have to tackle eventually. And then, you know, there was another big question that implicates the First Amendment that the court dodged this year involving partisan gerrymandering of election districts and whether, you know, if a legislature made up, say, of Republicans draws districts in a way, that disadvantages Democrats, mm-hmm. whether, you know, they're effectively undermining, you know, the speech rights of voters who support the minority party by making it, difficult, if not impossible, for them to elect candidates that they like. So that's another one that's looming.
What case, what state's that coming out of? Do you know?
Well, so we had a case, we had two cases this term, one from Maryland in which Democrats control and had basically redistricted in a way that cost the Republicans a congressional seat. And then we had a case from Wisconsin where in the state legislature there, Republicans drew the maps in a way where they were winning a majority of legislative seats, even though they'd lost the popular vote in the state. So in both of those cases, the court found ways to not tackle the core issue and sent them back. So both of those cases will go back to lower courts. And there's a similar case from North Carolina that raises the same issue. All of those are certain to come back here in the next year or two. I mean, whether the court takes them is a different question, but I mean, it will be back in front of them to potentially have to deal with.
As far as the labor union's case goes, it's Janus versus the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. When I read Alito's, a section of Alito's opinion on that case, he kind of was somewhat cavalier about the impact it would have on organized labor in the United States.
Well, again, I mean that's another point of disagreement between the two sides. I mean, they think it won't, and and the liberals think it will. I mean, I will say on that one, I mean, a couple things. One, you know, this applies just to public sector unions, not to private ones. And then B, the court had been teeing up this dispute for years. I mean, they'd had a couple of earlier cases, one they ruled incrementally in, and then there was a case from California a few years back where the court seemed poised to do the very same thing that it ended up doing this term, but then Justice Antonin Scalia died, and that basically deprived the court of a fifth vote for a majority there. And so with the court deadlocked, that kind of postponed things for another day. And then when we have Justice Gorsuch now, the court was able to do it this year. But I mean, you're correct. I mean, there's, you know, from the conservative vantage point, I mean, they don't see as what they did as some sort of death blow for unions, where, you know, the liberals tend to see this having much more of a substantive impact.
And Brent Kendall, tell me, why did it only apply to public unions and not private? So that would be like, AFSCME versus AFL-CIO, right?
Well, you know, the First Amendment, you know, constrains the government from restricting speech. So, you know, if what a private employer does vis-a-vis its union, it doesn't raise the same kind of First Amendment issues as opposed when the government is the employer, and it is, you know, here we have state laws that set out, you know, arrangements with which, you know, government agencies, public employers, deal with unions representing public workers and what fees those public workers have to pay to be represented.
Brent Kendall, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Brent Kendall, Wall Street Journal legal affairs reporter. Coming up, we're going to dive a little bit deeper into these issues, these First Amendment issues, and what's gone before the court this season. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, and you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The First Amendment is where we often hear the term freedom of speech. It's a rallying cry on both sides of the aisle, and in recent years, it's been used for political gain in and outside of the courts. So we're talking about the courts today, the U.S. Supreme Court in particular. We have OSU law professor Cortland Roser-Jones with us to discuss the First Amendment and how people are using freedom of speech. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thank you for having me.
Justice Kagan referenced it as a weaponization of the First Amendment, what's been going on there this term. What do you make of that? Is that incendiary? Is it appropriate? What do you think?
I don't necessarily think it's incendiary. I think it is appropriately strong wording from a justice who's not necessarily known for using maybe superfluous language that doesn't need to be there. And this is a really unique dissent from Justice Kagan, where she's usually a very strategic writer. And, you know, she is calling her colleagues black-robed rulers. You know, we hear this term that, I mean, we have a black-robed ruler who is calling the rest of her colleagues and really calling out the entire judiciary for saying that maybe we are using speech in a way it wasn't meant to be used. And I think that this, maybe this idea of weaponizing the First Amendment has been around in academic circles and for a couple of years. But I mean, I think that this is really one of the first dissents that we need to watch. I think that it's a worthy read for all of your readers, and I know that sometimes Supreme Court cases who wants to read the whole, you know, pages, but you should at least read her dissent, the last page, print it out, tape it somewhere, because it is just so vivid and a really interesting prediction of where we're going in the next couple of years.
Let's talk about what was meant by the First Amendment back in the day. It was the First Amendment, so it was the first thing they thought of when they thought about amending the Constitution and fixing a few things.
Yeah. So one of the ideas behind Justice Kagan's use of weaponizing and wielding a sword that she uses in this case is that we're using it as a sword, whereas traditionally the First Amendment was seen more as a shield. The First Amendment was used by individuals as sort of a protection against the government for suppressing speech. It wasn't generally used or originally thought to be used for large corporations that are not necessarily unfavored, especially not in this court.
And of course, we're talking about the landmark it's escaping me.
Citizens United
case, yes. Which allowed for all this dark money and that kind of a thing.
Exactly, which was Citizens United was also a First Amendment case.
Right.
And that is when, I mean, that is probably the one that will go down in history is, you know, when we really started to see this shift. I would say that, you know, it started to come in through commercial speech and some other cases earlier than that. But that was the case that we really changed the game on this.
It makes me think of so many other issues that have come up over the years. Let's just take advertising and how regulated advertising is. And that had to do with the airwaves and the fact that people couldn't you know, you couldn't eventually sell cigarettes
exactly.
on television because we couldn't control the airwaves. Now it's not popular to sell them. It would be untoward. But I'm wondering, would that fly nowadays?
I think that those are the cases that are going to come up. And that's exactly the question they're going to ask. That's exactly one of the things about advertising is we're here sitting in a studio, and I don't think anybody doubts that what we're doing is speech, right? That is somehow mm-hmm. protected, or that is at least covered by the First Amendment. But the First Amendment is not a be-all, end-all test. We also weigh other interests, like the interest of your consumers in hearing completely bogus things on the radio, the interest of patients, you know, to hear things from their doctors. And the court has in the past weighed those interests as saying, okay, the consumers have a bigger interest than this, you know, than someone else coming on the radio and lying and get more profits. Now we're seeing that balancing test come out differently. If you see speech as an absolute right, or if you see speech at least as an extreme right that trumps other interests, then you may see some commercial advertising cases come up that say, no, this is my speech right to say whatever I want on the radio.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the First Amendment. There's been a lot of activity regarding the First Amendment in recent years. My guest, Courtland Roser Jones, is an assistant professor of constitutional law at Ohio State's Moritz College of Law. What do you think out there? You've been following this. Do you care? What do you think about the idea of suddenly having all kinds of speech issues before the court, overturning things that we have lived with for generations now? For instance, no cigarette advertising on television, that kind of a thing. What do you think? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Was this unexpected, or do you think the Citizens United was the first shot across the bow?
I think Citizens United was the first shot across the bow. I don't think when we look at the cases that came through this term specifically, yeah. I think Janus had already
been debated.
Had already
years.
Been debated. This case specifically, we were not surprised.
That was the organized labor case
exactly.
that said that the free speech rights of the non-union members were being trampled by them having to pay dues to the union to benefit from the collective bargaining agreements.
Exactly. And when you talk about precedent that's being overruled or cases that are overruled, this was a 41-year-old decision that we overruled in Janus. This was litigated and decided in a case called Abood v. Detroit Board of Education in 1977. Same issues, same First Amendment rights being looked at. And Janus v. AFSCME is overruling, you know, four decades of precedent on a free speech claim.
And it affects public employees. Do you see an avenue by which it could affect the AFL-CIO of the world? I mean, the private, you know, the SEIU, the different private unions. Is there a way?
Is there a way? I think there is a way. There is a way. So without getting too constitutional for your listeners, it's early in the morning still for me.
The public media, they get it.
They get it, right? Yeah, I mean, right. One of the reasons this is brought in the public sector is one of these problems with state action. And, you know, if you're a private employer, what is the state's role in, you know, basically regulating your employment? So you've seen these cases come up in the public sector because that's a judicial hurdle that is a lot easier to overcome.
Because it clearly says
right.
it addresses the...
The employer is the state,
is
right?
The state,
the employer
right.
is the government.
Mm-hmm. And Congress, no law shall be made, right?
Exactly, yeah. right. So that is easier. I think that you might see a little bit more litigation in the public sector first before you really see it transition over into the private sector. And I also think in the private sector, one of the ways that we have been able to get to the same result is through right to work litigation, right? Hmm. You can just pass right to work litigation that can apply to the private and the public sphere. And that is a little bit less messy than going the constitutional route.
Mm-hmm. Right to work being really pretty much the ultimate banishment of unions in a state that where it you pass it the law saying that no one has to pay dues
right.
to any union.
Right. That's what right to work does. And one of the things that Janus looks at is right to work legislation doing the same thing in the private and the public, you know, the sectors has been this policy debate, right? I mean, ask your listeners in Ohio what it's like to go through a right to work, you know, legislative campaign. This is a question of democracy. And one of the key points to Janice, the takeaway is, are we taking away this energized policy debate where 22 states are right, you know, are not right to work and the rest are, and taking away that entire conversation, ending the debate. And who's ending the debate? Our black robed rulers, right? They're saying that the debate is over.
Ray in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Ray.
Hi. I just would like to point out that, in my opinion, both you and your guest are misrepresenting the holdings as far as the sword and the shield. Each of the recent cases, as well as Citizens United, the court used the First Amendment as a shield to protect the government from either prohibiting speech in Citizens United or mandating speech in the Janus case, as well as in the case out of the California with the pregnancy clinics. They're both saying the government cannot mandate that you say X or that you can't say Y. And that is exactly what the First Amendment was intended at its inception and through the press.
Well, I mean, just to take a little bit of issue, I'm just repeating what Justice Kagan said, a member of the United States Supreme Court, but point taken. Courtland Roser-Jones, what do you make of what Ray's saying here?
You're right. Point taken. I think I see your point, Ray. I would say that...
I guess it's a sword in one hand is a shield in another.
I think one of the things that we're looking at here is... So in these cases, the issue is not necessarily, at least from my perspective, that the government can never compel certain kinds of speech, right? We can compel professional speech, right? It's not necessarily that we can do that. The question is, how did we get there? And in these cases, we got there through a democratic debate about the interests in this state. And I think one of the keys to the First Amendment, maybe a fundamental, I see it as maybe a little bit of a misunderstanding, is that the First Amendment is a be-all, end-all. You get to say whatever you want. Remember, we don't get to say fire in a crowded theater. We have limits in terms of other interests that we balance in the First Amendment that are not necessarily the First Amendment that no government shall, you know, the government is looking at a bunch of interests in these cases. But I think you're absolutely right. Point taken. And I think one of the problems with, not a problem, but one of the issues with the First Amendment has been so, it's so grained in what we look at as what our, you know, what our Constitution is, what our government is supposed to protect. The First Amendment is the protection of democracy, right? It lets us have different views that are being said in this really, you know, in the political debate. Without the First Amendment, you don't have a minority view that's being presented. And I think that's why a lot of, you know, progressives have really been defenders of the First Amendment in the past. But I think that we need to look at the First Amendment in terms of what the, you know, what the speech is meant to be doing. There's some kind of speech, advertising speech, that we don't say that there is absolutely no regulation that the government can put on that kind of speech.
Ray, thanks a lot for that call. You know, another issue is political speech, campaigns, campaign speech, that kind of a thing. There's so much baloney out there on a regular basis now. The ethics commissions in states that are supposed to regulate political speech are toothless tigers. It's pretty well known. They don't take action on anything until after the elections, usually, unless it's something super heinous. What about political speech?
Yeah, political speech is another example of what we regulated for years, right? With McCain-Feingold is an example of what we did. You know, we did have regulations from the government on what could be, and maybe not political speech, we use political spending, right? Citizens United had to do with the kind of spending we could put through it.
As speech, yeah.
And there, I mean, there was not necessarily an issue of whether you could have the speech. It was whether, you know, when in the cycle of an election can that speech be said? And again, it's another balancing. The court looked at the interests of the voter in hearing different views and I think political speech is a great example. I think the court has a very hot button, too, for political speech because of the way our Constitution has come about is we look at political speech as, you know, the be all end all, what we protect over all other kinds of speech. It's very, you know, we put this through a very hard test.
Because, I mean, back in the day when the First Amendment was first penned, political speech was, I don't even know how to describe how vitriolic and full of lies and just hateful. I mean, they were very familiar with that back then.
Yeah, they were.
And they still wanted to protect it.
They were. And I would just put that another caveat to Citizens United that I would put in, you know, in Janice in this category too, is that now the conversation of whether political spending and political speech are the same thing, the court has seemed to come down on the answer of yes.
Yes, as well as cake decorating, for that matter, right?
Yes, yeah, I heard your Brent talking about earlier. I mean, that was a case that
It hasn't been dealt with yet.
It has not been dealt with, but the argument was incredibly interesting, where we dealt with whether florists were doing speech, expressive. You know, whether it is expressive to make this beautiful bouquet, whether food is expressive. So we are, and I think these... One of the things about Masterpiece Cake Shop that was interesting is just in taking the case was very much a statement piece by the court, because I think these cases were, you know, we didn't have this question before.
They took the case, but they didn't deal with it.
No, they didn't. I have no, you know, I have no, unfortunately, no information on that, except maybe Justice Kennedy ran out of steam a little bit. I think this was going, I was looking at this as being a big case for us this year.
And by the way, Kennedy had ruled on something similar to that as far as the commission, the Civil Rights Commission in Colorado and its treatment of the cake baker in a previous ruling, and apparently referenced that in his decision.
Yeah.
But it had nothing to do with the larger question of the case.
Something that I think we'll be looking at for years to come is how Kennedy has found that animus there in the Colorado Commission, when then you can compare him to other cases that we've seen, like Trump v. Hawaii, where we couldn't find any kind of religious animus in the outside, you know, conversations that were being had by our president, but we found some in this, what, you know, in this one small, you know, relatively small agency. So
animus being Trump v. Hawaii, when he was accusing the president of,
yes, right, Masterpiece Cake Shop comes down is a religious, you know, is comes down on the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, and you know, Kennedy goes to great lengths to find religious animus based on this one commissioner who says some things about religion, and really harps on that one statement. And I think some of us are still reeling who read these cases. Some of us are still reeling to try to reconcile that with Trump v. Hawaii, where Kennedy writes this with this concurrence where he kind of throws up his hands and says, yeah, we're not going to look at any of that outside animus stuff. We're just going to look at what the law, you know, what the executive order says. And I'm not going to bring in any of that other stuff.
So. Yeah, there's no law that says that the Supreme Court has to be consistent.
No, there isn't. And I think one of the reasons that Justice Kagan is so concerned about this is one of the most brilliant things about this First Amendment theory is you can find speech, you can find expressive activity in anything, right? I mean, I am, you know, you can really, especially anything that is regulated could arguably be some kind of expressive, even if you're expressing just that you don't want to be regulated by that. If that's the only kind of expressive, you know, aspect that you have. So one of her fears, I think, is that now everything's on the table and the judges can basically pick or choose. And when when Brett was talking about the gerrymandering cases, there are First Amendment claims brought in that and the court didn't touch them. You know, so this was another example of no thanks. You know, so it feels very much like now we're all going to bring First Amendment claims, and it's going to be up to the judges whether they're going to take them as meritorious or not.
We will continue our conversation. My guest is Courtland Roser Jones. She's an assistant professor of constitutional law at the Moritz College of Law at OSU. We're talking about the First Amendment today. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the First Amendment today. Three recent high-profile Supreme Court decisions have drawn from the First Amendment and asked the question, what is protected? The Supreme Court didn't always respond with a clear answer in every case, but the questions were asked. One example is if the money you pay to a union for collective bargaining is protected, if you should have to do that, if it's misusing your freedom of speech, if you disagree with the union, but that you pay them for the collective bargaining that you enjoy. The First Amendment is dynamic. It's up for legal interpretation, as we know, and we're talking about how far it can go. OSU Law Professor Courtland Roser Jones is still with us. Joining us by phone is Alan Chen. He's co-author of the 2017 book Free Speech Beyond Words, and he teaches at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about, you know, Alan, the idea of nonverbal expression like music or art and how it counts as speech. When did this get to be a thing?
So what's interesting about speech is one of the things that is most difficult, I think, in First Amendment doctrine, and this may be one of the reasons the court dodged the question in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, is what counts as speech, right? There's a universe of human communication out there. Lots of it doesn't even matter to the First Amendment. So, for example, there verbal expression that involves an actual threat to somebody is not even considered as speech under the First Amendment. Solicitation of a crime, A tells B to kill C. That's speech technically, but it's not the type of speech that the First Amendment even is concerned with. So the question is what is it concerned with? Overt political expression is covered by the First Amendment, but there's a vast range of other things, including entertainment, music, artistic expression. That don't necessarily use words, but have an expressive component. And the difficult thing is that the court has never really set out a clear set of guidelines for figuring out what counts as speech and what doesn't. And so things like music without words, for example, we think of speech as verbal, right? And but at the same time, the Supreme Court is acknowledged without explaining why that instrumental music would be protected as expression under the First Amendment, even though it doesn't appeal to, you know, cognitive reasoning or ideas in particular.
What was the basis for that?
This sort of comes out of dicta in a case involving whether a parade is an expressive activity. Parade, Irish American parade in New York City. An organization chooses to exclude an LGBT Irish group from participating in the parade, and the question is a parade, and their claim is that being compelled to have this particular group in their matrix of paraders is going to affect the message that they express. And one of the things the Supreme Court said in that case, yes, is a parade is expressive even though it doesn't convey a particular, you know, particularized message that we could articulate. And then the court in sort of the side comment says, of course, things that don't express things verbally must be protected under the Constitution. Otherwise, instrumental music and abstract art and even words of nonsense like the poem Jabberwocky would not be considered to be speech, right? So that brings us back to Masterpiece Cake Shop, right? So the the you know, obviously there's an extremely compelling interest that the state has in protecting people from discrimination on the basis of protected classes, whether it's race, gender, sexual orientation, religion. And in that case, I actually sort of, in a preview last fall, said this is the hardest case on the court's docket this year, because it's almost and one of the hardest things that they're going to have to deal with if they resolve it as it was presented is baking a cake for a same-sex marriage. Does it have an expressive component to it? And I think that's a really hard question. It's something we talk about in our book and don't actually resolve.
There's competing interests, too. There's the interest of the artist, the cake baker, versus the interest of the customer who doesn't want to be discriminated against.
Of course, right. And the state's interest in protecting that customer from discrimination. Mm-hmm. And another thing I think that was really difficult in the Matchbeats cake shop case was the court wasn't going to make a categorical exclusion from for expressive businesses that engage in expression for all civil rights laws. Mm-hmm. For example, if you had a person who was not going to bake a cake for an African-American family because of their religious beliefs, you know, sort of it offended some sort of deep-seated religious belief, they weren't going to create a general broad exemption for all anti-discrimination laws. I think that was another issue that they were really unwilling to confront because they didn't really want to go down that road.
I want to take a call from Abdul now in Columbus. Abdul, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm really interested in this topic. And the first question I'm going to ask is, since we're discussing about the First Amendment, that it guarantees freedom of concerning religion is the first word that comes up when you look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, are this ban concerning the people that are traveling from Muslim major countries, let's say perhaps the businessman who's seeking a visa coming here, mm-hmm. was rejected. So does this First Amendment protect people that are not American citizens?
Okay, so do the amendments to the Constitution, does the Constitution protect people who are not American citizens? Alan Chen?
It depends on which provision of the Constitution, but certainly the First Amendment applies to non-citizens as well. There are narrow parts of the Constitution that are expressly only apply to citizens, but the First Amendment is not one of them.
And then is the issue as far as, you know, the ban the travel ban from those countries that Abdul is mentioning, that's why they amended it and changed it to not be all Muslim majority countries was because it was considered unconstitutional, right?
Right. Well, I mean, that was clearly what the Trump administration was trying to do in travel ban. I think, I don't know, 3.0, I think, by the time it got to the Supreme Court, adding, you know, so you can imagine lawyers sitting in the White House saying, well, let's add North Korea in. Because that's not a Muslim majority country, and then it looks then we're good. Right? This is extremely problematic. I think I certainly agree with the dissent in the travel ban case, because it makes it so that any government official could basically come in and basically. I saw the expression animus laundering on Twitter. Right. In other words, you have a malicious intent for a particular religious group, and then you get caught, and then you say, oh, well, we actually didn't mean that, and here's the new rule that covers that up.
Mm-hmm.
And as if the original animus is just wiped out by the later decision. I think that's extremely problematic in all areas of law.
Yeah. Cortland Roser-Jones?
Yeah. Ellen, if I could ask you a question, just because I have you and you're, you know, calling from Denver, is when I was reading the Masterpiece Cake Shop and looking for the religious animus that Kennedy found, I was wondering if you know, is there more going on in that case, or is that really it? Is that all the animus that there was in this commissioner, the statements, or are you an insider, and can you tell me, is this a known thing that in Colorado that I should know of, that this is...
Yeah. No, so there's two things that the court draws on in yeah. terms of the animus. So one is the statements of that commissioner,
right?
As you pointed out, I think earlier, seemed to pale by comparison to the statements by the president about the Muslim ban.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I recently found out about that is that those statements were actually in a post adjudication hearing. It was
okay.
in a motion to stay the order while it was pending appeal. It wasn't even on the merits. But there's also these prior commission rulings that Justice Kennedy refers to
mm-hmm.
where a civil rights complaint was rejected mm-hmm. on behalf of sort of a person who wanted to have a cake made that had sort of anti-LGBT statements on it. And that person complained to the commission, and that complaint was denied. And so I think he was sort of trying to piece together that
those
with the statements of the commissioner. Yeah.
Okay.
But no, I have no inside information other than they scoured the record to try to find a way to avoid deciding the hard issue in this case.
Yeah.
You know, Ellen Chen, why would they even take it up if they're trying to avoid dealing with it?
It's a great question. I think they obviously thought they were going to deal with it when they first of all, it only takes four justices to grant review in a case,
okay.
and so it's possible that those four might not have even included Justice Kennedy, it's certainly possible that and there are times when the court grants cert in a case and then. A few months into the case, after the briefing is in, they say, whoops, maybe we don't actually want to decide this case right now. The other thing is that this issue is going to come back to the court at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, there are not a ton of lower court decisions addressing this specific issue. And I think they might have just decided we're going to punt for now and we're going to revisit this issue after the lower courts have grappled with it.
Mm-hmm. Abdul, I hope that we've answered your question. Thanks for your call. An email from Jill. Recent cases like the one in New Zealand, as if to balance the Citizens United mindset, have found that rivers and other earthly bodies also have personhood. What will happen when the interests of such life-giving entities come up against the corporate personhoods the Supreme Court has empowered? Of course, New Zealand's another country, but
yeah.
But what Cortland Roser Jones, what do you think of Jill's query?
No, it's interesting. I think that is where I was probably on the same line of thought after Citizens United. There's some language in Citizens United that I thought might actually look at union personhood, right? I mean, the union itself is being a personhood. What I would say to your email is that it's probably this court is a very pro-business court. So I think I don't know if it's a pro-river court yet, and I don't mm-hmm. think it's going to be. but I think
I can answer that. It's not.
It is not a pro-river.
but they have to. I mean. It is an intriguing concept. Who protects the river? Who speaks for the river? Does the river have speech rights?
Right. There's actually an old law review article called "Do Trees Have Standing?" And there's a question about, but it raises an interesting question. And the current court, of course, is not particularly receptive to these types of arguments.
Yeah.
But there have been in the lower court some efforts recently, for example, to argue that animals have standing mm-hmm. In terms of animal cruelty lawsuits because they are, you know, living sentient beings, and so that issue might come before the court. I don't think we're going to see this court recognize sort of natural resources as having standing.
No.
Ellen Chen, where do you see this going, given the recent proliferation of issues regarding the First Amendment? Cortland Roser Jones said earlier, you know, they may take a break for a term
mm-hmm.
While the new justice, whoever that might be, gets their sea legs. But be that as it may, do you see this unwrapping a lot of issues going forward?
Yeah, I think it's a great point. I wouldn't be surprised if they took a term with maybe fewer First Amendment cases mm-hmm. In the coming term. This was a pretty robust one. I think they are going to kind of want to see what the new justice, how the new justice changes the composition of the courts. But I think her earlier point about this idea that what's called the deregulatory First Amendment, using it to attack all sorts of social and economic regulations, as Justice Kagan warned about in her dissent, I think in I think it was in Janus, is going to be a really, really important part of the court's agenda in the next few years, and sort of figuring out where that line should be drawn.
Right, Alan. I guess that answers a part of my question. Is maybe you have a more optimistic view than Justice Kagan, because I am looking at her, when I was reading Janus, her statement about speech being everywhere and therefore, you know, the majority's road is going to run long. Do you have maybe a response that's more optimistic than that, that actually speech is everywhere, but not speech for the First Amendment's purposes? I mean, what is the response to her doom and gloom that there's no line to the end of this?
Yeah, I think she's writing for a wider audience, right? I think she's trying to alert litigants and professors and the public that, you know, this assault on regulations is coming. And I think that, you know, like a lot of things in constitutional history, we sort of go through these sort of ebbs and flows of how the different amendments are interpreted. I think there's going to be some pushback in the next few terms against that view. So I'm not quite as pessimistic as she is.
Okay.
Alan Chen, thank you so much for your time today.
You're very welcome. Nice Alan, chatting with you.
You bet. Alan Chen, co-author of the 2017 book Free Speech Beyond Words and professor of law at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law. Also, Courtland Roser-Jones, thanks to you as well. Courtland Roser-Jones is an assistant professor of constitutional law at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.